Blog Talk Radio.
My name is Jawanza. Thank you so much for tuning in today. As always, I always state, and I have to state, I don't take you for granted. I do realize that you could be doing something else, but you've taken time out of your day to spend it with me and my special guest, and so I am so very, very thankful for that. If you've been following Health, Wealth, and Divine for any length of time, you know that one of our regular guests is the Paramount King of the Osaraset region in Washington, D.C. His name is Orwa Hehi Metura Nkamit. Well, we've done a series before on the 11 Laws of God, which we completed not too long ago, where we just started a new series on the Asante model. We're actually looking at the Asante model and looking at the different aspects of that society and traditionally, and seeing how we can take some of those principles and utilize them today. And if you missed last week's show, I'm going to encourage you to go back into the archives and listen to it. We actually did an overview, and Brother Orwa actually, well, matter of fact, the overview was 2 weeks ago. Last week we looked at the Asante model, the political and the spiritual systems, and that was part one of that, and that is a very, very powerful information. Very, very powerful interview with a lot of powerful information, and I encourage you, if you missed that, to go back and listen to that again. But in case you're tuning in for the very first time and you don't know who my special guest is, well, I guarantee you, you won't forget after today's show. My special guest is Orwa Hehi Metura Nkamit, and he's been a member of the Osaraset Society since 1975, and he was appointed Orwa, or Paramount King, by Shechem Meshechem Ra'un Nefer Amen, who is chief priest and king of the Osaraset Society. As Orwa, he's responsible for guiding the lives of Osaraset's members and the society's activities in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. He's a member of the society's Carry Hair Priesthood and headed Osaraset's African Support Project. He also holds a bachelor's degree in African American Studies and a master's degree in education, both from Howard University. And he's also an author. He's written an awesome book called African Names, The Ancient Egyptian Keys to Unlocking Your Power and Destiny. Again, my special guest today is Orwa Hehi Metura Nkamit. Aneturak, welcome back to Jawanza for Life, or shall I say Health, Wealth, and Divine. How are you, my brother?
I'm doing well. Thank you again for the invitation and the opportunity to share.
It's my pleasure, and as I mentioned to the listeners, I know that they enjoyed it as much as I have. I've been looking at the archives, and they're going back and continuing to listen. I know they're loving this information, and we are, as I stated, doing a series looking at the Asante and using them as a model. And last week we started with the political slash spiritual aspects of this discussion, and today we're going to be picking up on that, and this will be part two of that discussion. Brother Orwa, if we could just again, without, because I know that we can always go back, and or the listeners can always go back and listen to the archives. If you missed the overview, go back and check out the archives, and that will bring you up to speed on just the overview of why we're doing the series and what you can expect to get out of the series. And again, part one was last week. We're starting with part two. But Brother Orwak, if you don't mind, just for the audience, for those who are just tuning in for the first time, without going into the overview all over again, but why the Asante model? What is it about the Asante that we need to look at, and why specifically that particular model are we focusing on?
Well, again, the our focus as the Asarasa Society is the reclamation and preservation of our African spiritual tradition. Our foundational infrastructure is structured around the principles and teachings and guidance that we receive from ancient Kemet, so-called ancient Egypt. But we also look for and try to extract and utilize elements of value and truth that we find in other traditions. I mean, there are things that indigenous people do in parts of the world that are of value. And so, you know, there's a saying that the wise man doesn't just eat at home. I mean, you have to go out and find truth and value wherever it is and apply it to your life.
Yes.
And so, through our relationship that we discussed in terms of the building of that relationship with the Asante for, you know, the past 30 plus years, their ability to hold on to and preserve against a lot of outside influences, to whatever degree they have been able to preserve their kingship model, the kingship system, the divine kingship system. We look for elements within the kingship system that is a value that we can use, but equally as important, elements within their system that link up with that from ancient Kemet. And so the project that I was engaged in was kind of focused on those two platforms, looking for value in the traditional model. But when we look at, you know, when we look at political organizational structure, we find again that our ancestors have always preferred, from the beginning of recorded time, from before recorded time, the divine kingship model. But for the last several hundred years, we've been forced to interact with the Western model of leadership, political organization, which today has been, you know, it's the socialism and communism and so-called democracy, et cetera. And the role and the goal and the application of those models. But when we look at the history in terms of how have we fared under these new models, we don't see the same kind of social, political, economic stability within our traditional systems, within our societies, that we have with the traditional model. So the goal was to look and see what of value is still within the traditional model, and to see what principles we can extract from the traditional model that can serve us today as we begin to, as we live our lives trying to adopt and adapt to the ever-changing world in a sustainable way. So the project was based on trying to identify whether or not and how the divine kingship of Asante is a sustainable model for political, social, economic, and environmental development. And that those same values and principles can be applied to other leadership elements within the larger society, meaning not just Asante community, but in, within Ghana as a whole in terms of political structure, as well as maybe things that are there that could and should be applied to leadership models in other parts of the world as well.
Well, you know, what I'd like to, if we can, I have a question, and that would be the role of ritual because you mentioned in last week's show, you talked about the Dua and the Sua, and it was the three pronged, I guess for lack of a better term, fork kind of that held the bowl where the people would actually collect the rain and then use that or bathe with it, or if somebody was sick, work with them with that. And then the other ritual where they would actually take the water and trace, I guess, a symbol of or a circle around what would be commonly known as the third eye. And, you know, different rituals that actually served to remind them of their connection with God and the importance of rituals in traditional African society, the Asante in particular, since that's what we're discussing today. And then how rituals even today can actually serve to keep that God focus in our presence, in the forefront of our mind. So if you could talk about rituals, I'm sorry, the Inyame Sua and the Inyame Dua.
Well, just as kind of a recap and then an extension. Historically, the traditional Asante culture, there was a process by which members of the culture, the society, in order to maintain and strengthen their connection with the Supreme Being. We know from our teachings in ancient canon that the goal of each person's life was to become a divine being, a God-man or a God-woman, meaning to become a vehicle through which the fullness of what we call the Supreme Being can express itself on earth through us as it is established in what we call the fourth way to heaven. And the Asante has also this as a model in terms of what each individual, how individuals should enact in their daily life in order to try to unite with that Godhead as a part of and to bring forth that divinity in their life, to overcome sin, to not sin, which is mean to be one with God. Because again, as the Asante believes that to sin is a violation against God. So by not sinning, one is at one with God. And the process was, this practice was performed at a shrine called Inyame Dua, which meant God's tree. The process itself was called Inyame Su, which means the character of God. It was a process where each day the individual would go to this altar, Inyame Dua, and dip their finger into the basin where the water was collected, either from gathered from the rain or from the stream, and then encircle the forehead while they visualize themselves not sinning and being at one with God. Now what we identified or we spoke of last week was the fact that this process is in direct linkage with the practices of ancient canon. But it wasn't just in Inyame Su. There's also a process called the soul washing that they would do weekly, meaning there's 7 days in the week, and each person, a Asante person, is born on one of those 7 days. So whatever day they were born, that day is impressed with certain qualities, certain potential, certain behavior, characteristics, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And so each person then was traditionally and historically, on the day of their birth, they would do what's called the soul washing. So the Accra, which is the symbol, which is the term that they use to identify the spark of the divine that's in man, which they also say is resident within the head. So they would wash the soul of the Accra weekly on the day of their birth. And again, this whole process to wash something is to clean it. To clean it means that it's been soiled or whatever, or to extract it into the context of what we're discussing, we're talking about washing away the sins of the past week. So every week they would do the soul washing, which is, again, to clear away the sin, to put themselves in a pure position and posture, so that in the coming week they would avoid those sins. And then every day they would do this in Yamisu, designed to do the same thing, to link them mentally and psychically with what it meant to be a divine being on earth. Because a Yami is the term for the supreme being in the Khan culture. So, this practice of the Nyamisu and then the soul washing, the cloud washing, were two behaviors that they participated in order to unite themselves and be at one with the Supreme Being. Now, in ancient Kano, we find the same practice, but it's through what we call the Declarations of Freedom from Sin, the so-called 42 Declarations of Ma'at.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as we discussed in the series we've been talking about with the 11 laws, there are 11 laws. The 11 laws are the faculties within man and God's spirit through which we're able to function as a divine being on earth. And in order not to violate these 11 laws, the people of ancient Kemet would go through this process nightly, this ritual nightly, where they would pledge themselves to be free of sin, meaning I have not violated this particular law within my being.
Mm-hmm.
So every day they're going through the same kind of process and ritual that the people in Asante were doing with the Nyamisu and the soul washing process. So we're saying, I have not done so and so nightly as we go into the meditation. All this is geared toward being what? Cleaning one's spirit, being one with God, avoiding sin, overcoming sin, in order to become a God man or a God woman on earth.
Mm-hmm. You know what's very interesting about all of this and the whole perspective is that the act of becoming a God man or a God woman had to supersede any other earthly desire, any other earthly, you know, pleasure, any other earthly goal. You know, just the act of, I mean, to go through this ritual daily, weekly, you know, and however other often they had rituals that they performed, that just reinforces the goal, of course, which is to become a divine man or a God or a divine woman, which says to me that this had to be the highest, this had to, you know, be higher than any earthly pursuits, you know. And with that in mind, I'm reminded of even last week how you spoke about how when the individual kings of their prospective regions decided that, okay, we need to come together, then, you know, the thought of the good and of the whole had to be considered, and their own individual, perks, for lack of a better term, that they may have received as being kings of a particular region had to be put aside so that the good of the whole could be sought after. And I'm sure that the rituals that they did daily, weekly, you know, contributed towards the mindset that would allow them to do that.
Yes. And it's again, all this is wrapped up in the concept of who am I? What's my purpose for life? What's my destiny?
Mm-hmm.
In ancient Kemet, we say that, you know, the highest law of the spirit is Amen, which means to be at peace. If I'm at peace, that means that there's nothing that can disturb that peace. So whatever is going on in the earthly experience, through my earthly experience, is there to give me the opportunity to reinforce that peace and not to disrupt the peace. And because through that peace, I manifest on earth my true divinity and my identity, which is within the Kemetic system was identified as being an Osir, the man or woman who has lived this peace, and by virtue of living this peace, their spirit is at peace, and therefore they're one with God. But so within the Asante model, we have the same concept, the same approach, the same connections, really. When you look at Inyame, right? Inyame is a term that means within the Asante language itself, to Inya means to get, and Me means to be full. So when we look at the word Inyame, or the term for the Supreme Being, it means, and they say in their language, that one, when one has Inyame, one is full, one is satisfied.
Okay.
Well, to be satisfied means that you're what? You're at peace. It's the same principle.
Right.
And so what we then looked at is, if we take the law of Amen, which says you're made in the likeness of a peace that nothing can disturb, reclaim your peace that you may attain to your reason for coming into existence, the enjoyment of life, and look at the reasoning that follows that law, which says, if in truth it is our nature to be at peace, free of all negative emotional responses and situations of challenge, then the only thing we need to do is to ignore the emotional reflexes that come up in social in such situations.
Right.
What is the point of suffering and destroying our health and performance abilities if we can be at peace, especially when the peace in situations of challenge leads to enhanced intuition and spiritual power? So if we take that same concept, the law, and substitute the word Inyame for the word Amen, it reads as such. You were made in the likeness of a peace that nothing can disturb, because your every need is satisfied. You are complete. Reclaim your neat peace that you may attain to the reason for your coming to existence, the enjoyment for life. And apply the same Inyame in the reasoning statement is, if the truth, our nature is to be at peace because we are full, hence not in need of anything, we are therefore free of automatic emotional responses in situations of challenge. Then the only thing that we need to do is to ignore the emotional reflexes which are trying to add something to into the spirit, which is full, hence cannot be added to, cannot be manipulated with. Then come up with situations, since we are already full, meaning complete, what is the point of emoting over this thing or that thing, which leads to suffering and destroying our health and performance abilities, if we can be at peace, especially when the peace in situations of challenge leads to enhanced intuition and spiritual power. So you see that these two concepts, the concept of Amen, an ancient Kemet, it links in directly with the concept of Inyame that the Asante look at. So we can see that in addition to the other cultural elements, that the concept of what the Supreme Being is and my relationship to the Supreme Being is easily connected in both traditions. Now,
well, you know what's interesting, Brother Orwai, is that when you look at governments and, you know, societies, they're made up of people. And we're talking about, again, specifically the African traditional model of the Asante, which was made up of people. And so when you had somebody, a king would be concerned, can be considered an individual, you know, his cabinet, for lack of a better term, or staff, or the people that worked with him, the priests, the, you know, counselors, and the, you know, accountants and everybody, these are people. And so if each individual goal in life was to become may not have been called an Osir there, or to become one with Inyame in the Asante culture, at some point, in order for a person to actually have lived a life where they can say, for example, at the end of a day, I have not committed sin, I have not done this, or I have not done that, at some point, and I know that traditional Africa, and even present Africa, traditional religions have initiations. Could you discuss the importance of initiations and the role that that plays in the structure of creating a society in which one can be able to say, I have overcome sin.
Well, the initiation process is the vehicle through which we're able to extend the concept of who we are and link into, tap into that raw force, that spirit, with the proper ideal of who I am to make the transformations within that spirit. Meaning, we come into the world not in isolation, but we come into an environment, a community, a nation, whatever. And whatever are the practices and the ideas and the philosophies of that nation largely impact and circumscribe how we see who we are and what we can accomplish in our life.
Mm-hmm.
So take for example, the current status quo. You know, people say and believe that we are human beings, and as such, we are frailed with all kinds of limitations and problems and weaknesses, and we're mistake prone, etc. You've seen the commercial where the people push the TV out the thing onto the man's car, and it's what humans do.
Mm-hmm.
As long as we accept that that's what we are, then that's going to determine what we strive to be. If I accept the fact that I'm a human being, and by nature, human beings are frail, they're sinful, etc., then I'm going to immediately excuse any misstep, any ill behavior, with the excuse, well, I'm a human being. But if I don't accept that I'm a human being, if I accept that I'm a divine being, and I still make a mistake, I still sin or violate mistake, then I cannot accept that the mistake I made is okay.
Mm-hmm.
I have to accept that, yeah, I made a mistake, but now I have to attempt to do better. And to do better, I have to learn how to reprogram my spirit such that when I'm confronted with this situation, the automatic response that I come up with is not the sinful response, but the divine response. And if the culture, if the society doesn't have those processes, those mindsets, those behaviors programmed into the status quo, then what are people to do but to become center? You know, it's like if you have a pool, a pond, and the pond is contaminated, and people drink from the pond, then people are going to be contaminated. And if you don't have a way of pure cleaning up the situation, healing people, then everybody's going to be walking around in the same amount of contamination.
Mm-hmm.
So what initiation does is give us a vehicle through which we can, even though we're still drinking from the same dirty pond, it gives us the tools to clean up the impurities within our spirit from the contamination that we're taking in, such that we can now elevate our response mechanisms beyond those of a sick person, an ill person.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a part of the process and part of the reasoning that goes into the understanding that we are divine beings. If I accept the idea that I'm a divine being and that we're all by nature divine, but I see behaviors within myself or others that are less than divine, then I have to accept that, well, there's something amiss here. There's some illness here.
Mm-hmm.
And if I know that I'm ill, then I need to seek a cure for that illness.
Mm-hmm.
And so initiation becomes the cure for what's illing mankind today, the acceptance of the human self-identity as the norm, which in fact the initiation then allows us to see that, yes, I may be functioning as a human, but this is not the limit of what I can do. This is just a stage that I'm located at right now. And by going beyond this stage through the initiation process, I learned how to extend and to grow spiritually such that, yeah, I may be influenced by the same circumstances, environment, circumstances, but my response will change because I've reprogrammed my spirit to respond in a divine way versus the human way. The spirit is our vehicle of expression. And however our spirit is expressed is based on how it's programmed.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm functioning as a human being, then that means I'm programmed, my spirit has been programmed to do such. If I'm going to function as a divine being, that means I got to reprogram my spirit. But to reprogram my spirit, I need a model that I can use that will enable me to rewrite the code, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the initiation program is.
Well, you mentioned the spirit, and even in last week's discussion, you know, you talked briefly about the spirit, and of course we touched on consciousness versus, contrast to energy, matter, and, you know, you mentioned how Western society or Western man has not gone into really understanding, really, the spirit. Would this be a good place to even just discuss the anatomy of the spirit, because I don't want to take the conversation somewhere else. Would that fall into, because we're talking about political / spiritual, would this be a good point to discuss the anatomy of the spirit, to, you know, touch upon that, what the anatomy of the spirit is? Because you mentioned in last week's show how, I forget the gentleman's name, who went in the after the colonization of the Asante and asked, you know, one of the Asante, well, why do you all worship so many different, you know, deities or whatever? And the response was that you don't just worship the head, but, you know, there's a whole body. And spiritually, there's a whole body and not just the head. Would this be a good point to discuss briefly, the anatomy of the spirit, or would that be a different show?
Well, I mean, it's right in line with what we're discussing in that. The Kemetic, our ancestors in ancient Kemet, identified 7 major divisions of the spirit. And the spirit is, the vehicle through which the supreme being and man functions in the world. And when I say in the world, I'm not just talking about the physical world, but also the metaphysical world. So there's aspects of the spirit that are metaphysical, meaning beyond physical. And then there's aspects of the spirit that are physical, operate on the physical plane. And if we use the analogy of the human body, that if I want to address an issue with the body, then I need to know the anatomy of the body. If I can't just walk into a doctor and say I hurt, and him be able to fix me. So I got to be able to say I hurt here, and he needs to know what that here is. If that's the liver, the kidneys, or the knee, he needs to know the anatomy of that structure, how it operates, how it functions, the kinds of things that can cause it to this feeling of illness, and then the kinds of things that can be done in order to rectify the problem. So if I just have a term called spirit, and this is where Western culture falls down, in that they speak of the spirit, the Holy Spirit, etc., but, okay, that's just like saying the body. If I'm going to make a transformation in my life, I'm going to make a change in my life, I'm going to heal something that's wrong with my spirit, I need to be able to anatomically identify where the problem is and then know how that operation, that part of the spirit functions in order to know how to correct it so that it functions properly.
Mm-hmm.
So I just can't say I have a spiritual problem. I have a problem with this part of my spirit, and by knowing this part of the spirit, I know the laws, the ideals that operate on this level. I know the energies that vibrate on this level, and so I can attach responses that will help to balance out this energy. And when we study indigenous cultures around the world, we find that on different levels with different degrees of sophistication, they have these kinds of delineations. We have 7 in ancient Kemet, For example, in China, they primarily focus on three.
Okay.
The Khan has like about four or five.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we look for, again, the kinds of cross-referencing that will enable us to say, to link and understand and communicate, you know, through a common nomenclature. When I say this, how does this translate into this other culture? So
mm-hmm.
that then I can begin, we can have a basis for understanding one another's platform, one another's concepts, one another's practices.
Okay.
So, for example, we talked about the Accra, and now the Accra, or sometimes called the Kra, is what in ancient Kemp was called the Ka. And you can see immediately the connection. One is spelled K-R-A, the other spelled K-A.
Mm-hmm.
They mean the exact same thing in the two cultures.
Okay.
And I have read from one of the writers that the symbol, I know what the symbol for the Ka looks like. It's two arms that are upstretched. But then they described the symbol for the Kra, which had the same exact symbolism. I haven't seen the symbol because I've been trying to find it physically for myself, but
mm-hmm.
the writer is pretty credible in the fact that, you know, they make this connection. So within the Kemetic system, we have this thing called the Kaibit. So what is the Kaibit? The Kaibit is what the Chinese call Qi.
Hmm.
And it's the part of the energy that we extract from the environment that enables us to move and to function in the world, right? So the Kai, the electromagnetic, it operates on the physical level, and so we extract it from the physical environment. We take it in through the air we breathe. We take it in through the foods we eat, et cetera. We take it in through the things that come into our system, the sounds, the colors, et cetera. And we apply it. Now, in the Western context, this Kaibit or Qi has been, for lack of a better word, certified through the process called Kirlian photography.
Okay.
Where they're able, and we've all heard of the concept of an aura, right, which is the outer fringes of the Kaibit. So the Kaibit presents itself as this shadowy energy around the physical body. It's the energy through which the acupuncturist manipulates when he's working with his protocol to stimulate the flow of energy through these channels, these organic channels. In this valley tradition, it's called Kundalini. It's the flow of this energy. So it's the energy, it's called the vital energy or the energy body, et cetera, or and it's called the ghost even in some traditions. Well, in 1955 or thereabouts, a Russian scientist named Kirlian developed a camera that enabled one to photograph this Kaibit or this aura or this chi energy around things or this Kundalini energy around things. Etc., which verify that, you know, it exists, and you can see it with the picture.
Okay.
Now, this concept of Kaibit, which is a part of the Ra, which is the overall term, generic term for the spirit, which has these different fibers, these different parts. So the Kaibit becomes the electromagnetic part of the energy that nourishes and feeds the physical vehicle. So when a person dies, they give up the ghost, so to speak. They give up their Kaibit, kind of
mm-hmm.
leaves the body. And for a period of time, their organs remain viable so that it enables organs to be transplanted. But ultimately, you know, the whole body becomes lifeless without energy, without this vital essence.
Okay.
Now, we know scientifically, now they know everything that goes into making blood, but they can't reproduce it in the laboratory. Because there's this vital energy, this Kaibit, this chi, that is something that is not a physical structure. It's the environment, it's the electromagnetic. It's a spiritual force that imbues the physical world. Now, amongst the Akan, or the Asante specifically, the Akan in general, there's this concept called Sunsun.
I'm sorry, what's it called?
Sunsun.
Okay.
Sun, S-U-N-S-U-M.
Okay.
Sunsun, spell Sunsun. And it's the exact same description, right? We talk about a person that has low chi, meaning mm-hmm. has low vitality, et cetera. Well, if someone says you have low Sunsun, they mean the same thing. If you have strong Sunsun, it means the same thing. You have strong chi, you have strong force, you have strong vitality.
Okay.
And so this is a means, again, of linking up these spiritual practices from different traditions, which are talking about the same reality. So again, when we talk about the Akan or the Asante tracing their lineage back to the northeastern part of Africa and to what we could today call the Nile Valley, then we're talking about people who migrate across through centuries but take with them certain values, certain principles, certain understandings of the spirit world that they incorporate and becomes a part of the woven fabric of their society, which links back right back to the practices of our ancestors in ancient Kemet. So you see the universality of these spirits, these concepts within African culture. And again, the reason why it's so important with the Akan is, with the Asante, is that they, against the onslaught of you know, colonization and the westernization of Ghana, et cetera, have been able to hold on to some of these principles and values and approaches, even though a lot of them have gradually disappeared. Like a Nyame Sioux, mm-hmm. it's hard to find somebody who's practicing that today. You know, that you, I, like I said, I couldn't find an Nyame Duo. I haven't seen one. I know there's some there, but I haven't seen them, whereas they used to be everywhere. So it's a concept that part of this work is hopefully that because, you know, what's undermined the culture, the Asante culture and African cultures in general, is the adopting of foreign spiritual ideals like Christianity, Islam, etc. And, you know, because you begin to, you accept different, you have a different paradigm. You know, in Christianity, you're born a sinner. Whereas in the traditional Asante model, sin is something that you do, but that's not what you are. You can evolve beyond it. Your goal is to go beyond it. Your goal is to become one with God, to reflect the character of God. Because character is the most important element within Asante culture. To become a king or a leader within the society, that's the first thing that, and the primal thing that is looked at. Everything else can be taught. Practices can be taught, rituals can be mm-hmm. taught, etc. But before a person is put in that position and trained to become the leader, they have to have this basic Asante character values already in place. People have to have seen them in this person through their mm-hmm. lifetime. And they begin to look at these people from birth, from through their childhood, through their young adulthood. Again, because they're classes of people called royals. And the royals are specific families within their communities. So everyone within the community will know who the royal family is, or families are, because there's normally more than one or two. Depends on the different, you know, different communities. Some of them there may be one, some of them may be three, some of them may be four. You know, it varies.
Okay.
But the point is that whenever a child is born in that out through that family, it's the family's responsibility to, one, train and cultivate that person to one day become a potential leader, and it's the community's responsibility to observe this person as they're growing, to be able to certify if this particular individual is the one that's chosen to be a leader, that, yes, they have the character, they demonstrate the character qualities through their life that will enable them to become the unifying force, the spiritual unifying force of the community. Because the person who becomes the leader within their kind system, within their society system, they rest upon the laurels and the accomplishments of their predecessors, their ancestors. And so the king, the new king or the new queen mother, they become the direct lineage of the previous kings and queen mothers. And there's many, in many situations, when they choose a name, they oftentimes choose a name of one of their predecessors, which is to say that this person is the reincarnation, or this person is now the extension of what this previous person they did, had done. Sometimes they keep their own name or change their own name and start a new name on the stool, a new stool name.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever the case, you don't become chosen by the queen mother. Doesn't choose a person to become the king if that person is a person of ill repute, if that person has bad character traits, if that person is a drunkard, if that person lies and steals, if that person cheats, if poses a womanizer. They will never get past the council that has to certify her choice. So she's not going to put her position in jeopardy by choosing someone who doesn't, so she knows, doesn't meet the qualifications, the character qualifications that are necessary to become a leader. So character, when we talk about Nyamesu being character of God, the character is the primal, the most important point, the most important factor in a person becoming a leader within the traditional sense. So all those who are chosen to take on political positions have to have demonstrated and have to be certified and agreed through the democratic process that when the Queen Mother nominates someone, then people have to now vote on that person. So we talk about democracy. Democracy is not something that Western man brought to Africa. True democracy has been in place in Africa for hundreds and thousands of years.
Okay.
It's Western man's view of democracy, or contortion of democracy, coming out of the Greek model of so-called democracy and the Roman experience, neither of which ever demonstrated pure democracy or true democracy, even in this society. After 200 years of this perfect union, we don't have. If we had true democracy in this country, then there would be no issue about whether or not they should renew the Voting Rights Act. We wouldn't be having that conversation. There wouldn't have been a need for a civil rights movement if we had true democracy. There wouldn't have been a need for the women's suffrage movement if we had true democracy. There wouldn't have been a civil war if we had true democracy. So, the ideal, the so-called perfect union that was created is not perfect, and it can't be perfect because there is nothing imbued within the context of the fabric of the Wolfen fabric of society, which leads and moves one and insists that people move toward perfection.
Well, I have two more questions because I know that time is of we're kind of winding it down, and that would be first. Let's talk about the oracles if we could then, because you mentioned the Queen Mother's role in the whole process of choosing who the next king is going to be. And, of course, that's based upon character of the prospective king. They've watched him, and he can't have any, flaws or whatever that would prohibit him from being considered the top choice. But if you could talk about the role of the oracles, because even you mentioned that the king on his staff has trained priests, and he, the king himself, being the chief priest. So the role then, if you would, just since we're tying this into the spirituality of traditional African culture and the Akan, the role that the oracles play in this whole discussion, how that system of relating to and communicating with God can and has been used.
Well, the short answer is that in order to make sure, because the ultimate goal of any good leader is to make sure I'm doing the right thing by and for my people,
mm-hmm.
which may or may not be what I personally think should be done, but I need to have a vehicle, a process through which I can get the divine perspective on what and how to approach a situation. And that's where the oracles come in. And within the Akan system, within the Asante system, there are priests and priestesses who are trained to do these kinds of readings to guide the king. Now, it is said by since the king is the chief priest of the nation, he can choose not to follow the guidance of his spiritual advisor.
Okay.
But a good chief, a good king, wouldn't do so. As
mm-hmm.
a matter of fact, the first king of the Asante Nation, Osei Tutu the First, Atunfo Osei Tutu the First, was advised not by his chief priest not to cross the Prau River. But he didn't listen, and he drowned.
Mm.
So there was a prohibition for, it's still in existence, even though it's kind of violated, that
mm-hmm.
the king should not cross the Prau River under certain circumstances.
Okay.
So there's a lot of important information and concept within the idea that, you know, God is one of the attributes of the Supreme Being is wisdom. And as a divine being, wisdom is a part of my being as well. But I may lack the cultivation at this point to access that wisdom faculty and apply it unobstructedly into my life. So then the oracles would provide me with a vehicle through which, a time-tested and proven vehicle through which I can communicate with the Supreme Being in order, while I'm cultivating and developing my spirit, so that one day this faculty will intuitively function within me, so I can, until that day comes when it's awakened within me, I can cultivate, use this process, this vehicle, however it's practiced, get the divine insight, the divine will, as it applies to any given situation.
Okay.
Which is important. Because, you know, a lot of people say they talk to God. And I'm not saying they don't.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to have some way of certifying that the answer they're getting is, in fact, the right answer. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jim Jones said he talked to God. And
hello.
I dare say that the answer he got was not the right answer. But
mm-hmm.
unfortunately, the people that were with him didn't have a vehicle to check, to cross-check, to fact-check, to divine-check
mm-hmm.
what the man was saying.
Right. Everybody, my special guest is Orwahehi Mentoran Kami. We got a couple of minutes left. I will defer my question for anybody else that has one. If you're online and you'd like to ask a question of Brother Orwa, press 1 and I can bring you on board. Or if you're listening by phone, the number is 347-324-5727. I meant if you're listening online, that number is 347-324-5727. Okay, it doesn't appear that anybody wants to ask a question. I see you up there. But then my next question would be the king. I know that in Western society here, for example, in the United States, the president is president for 4 years, and then they have another vote. How does that work in the Asante system? Do they vote every 4 years, or once he's king, is he king for life until he, you know, makes the transition? How does that work?
Yes, you're king for life, meaning that those who are put on the throne, unless they are destooled by the people, meaning removed from office by the people because of some violation that they perform, some most often character violations, or some violation of community law that they perform,
mm-hmm.
they stay on the throne until they pass. And at that point, then someone else is nominated and put on the throne. And if there's a man who qualifies to take the throne, there's been historically a situation, as we mentioned last week, where women have, queen mothers have assumed the kingship position because there were no men fit to rule at that point. So a person would stay on the throne until they pass. If they leave the throne for any reason, then they're not even counted as having been on the throne. A classic example of this is, everybody's familiar with Yaa Santua, the queen mother who led the Asante in the fight against the British in 1900. The British had, this is the third and final physical battle, war, that the Asante had fought with the British. This is the one that led to military subjugation of the Asante by the British, led to the colonial period, etc. And we, as we discussed last week, even though the Asante was subdued, they didn't really lose the war, because the objective of the war was the Golden Stool. The British governor, in his folly, demanded that the Golden Stool be brought to him so he could sit on it. Well, the Asante king doesn't even sit on the Golden Stool. The Golden Stool is not a seat. And so the man didn't understand what it was, or its significance, or its importance. Hence, his ignorant and arrogant request. But at any rate, so since they exiled the king, many of his council, and he thought that that would be enough for the people to give it up, but they refused to. And so Yaa Santua, the queen mother from Ijusu, one of the paramountcies, rallied the Asante and led the Asante in battle, which is not historically the women's role within the culture. Women are not looked upon as being fighters. Women give life. Women nurture life. Women are not traditionally put in positions to take life. But her position was that the men were not standing up to do what they needed to do, so she was going to lead the women to do it. And so that's just the final battle. And as such, then she is immortalized in the Asante tradition and culture. So now, she comes from one of the, I think it's three families within Ijusu, the royal families of Ijusu, that can put people on the stool, the queen mother or the paramount king. They call paramount chief. Well, in the 1950s, I don't know the exact date, that family had another, it was their turn to put another queen mother in position. And so that family, because of Yaa Santua was important within Asante culture, her same within Asante culture, anytime it's their responsibility to put a queen mother on the stool, they named that person Yaa Santua in succession. So in the 1950s or so, I don't know the exact date, a granddaughter of Yaa Santua the first was put on the throne. Her name was Yaa Santua the second. And now this was around the period and through the period of the ending of colonialization and the beginning of the so-called independent period. Now there was this internal strife that was going on coming out of the colonial experience. There's a lot of background information that led to the different facets of this strife. But essentially, during the colonial period, the British established this process called indirect rule. Indirect rule meant that they would keep the traditional system in place, the chiefs and queen mothers, etc. But the chiefs and queen mothers then would be responsive not to their people, but to the British overlord, the governor who was in charge of the thing. And because many of the traditional rulers refused to do such, then they were removed from their position, and the British government then put illegitimate people who weren't of the royal family, many cases and other, into these positions, And so the people did not accept these people as the rightful rulers.
Mm-hmm.
And so this led to a lot of confusion and strife and with independence, because a lot of people were upset behind some of the behaviors of these illegitimate chiefs and queen mothers, et cetera, that were put in place. This led to some strife when Nkrumah took over the country, the government,
mm-hmm.
and began to try to work through this process. So many people, then there led to a strife between Nkrumah and the traditional Asante chief. So the Asante, Nkrumah was the head of the TPP party. And so the Asante chief, the traditional Asante, because they had these illegitimate people in place, formed their own political party, which led
mm-hmm.
to a strike. And so there was this back and forth, and Nkrumah had some issues with the Asante. A couple of times when he went there to speak, he was, driven out because of this, the role that the traditional rulers had been forced to accept
mm-hmm.
through this indirect rule. So at any rate, so the Asante formed their own political party, and this led to some strife between the CDP and the Asante political party. And so Yaa Asantewaa the second was a part of this of the Asante party. And but there were people in the Jisu who wanted to take control of the throne, so they were working with the CPP. So because
mm-hmm.
of it, and so her life was threatened, so she had to flee from Ijesu in order to save her life. So she then, and when she was in quote-unquote exile, she then renounced, gave up the stool, so she could come back and live without the threat of being taken out.
Mm-hmm.
So because she gave up the stool, she's not classified as having rule. So her granddaughter now is Yaa Asantewaa the second. So that whole Yaa Asantewaa the second thing was just skipped. It's as though there was never another Yaa Asantewaa prior to this one.
Wow.
So you have to die on the stool in order to be counted as a occupant of the stool. And there's all kinds of things that took place in this whole colonial period. And many of the people, which is why many of the people, as one of the paramount chiefs told me, because many of the people were subjugated and subjected by these rulers, these indirect rulers, who were the illegitimate chiefs in their communities, many of them ran to Christianity because they thought it was a vehicle to free themselves from the control of these wrongful rulers
mm-hmm.
who've been put in their place. And so we had the whole discussion last week about how the culture, the spiritual culture, has been undermined through the acceptance of these Christianity and Islam, et cetera.
You know, this information is so very interesting to me, and just the fact that this queen, Yaa Asantewaa, who just had, did so much, for the Asante, and then in the end, basically had her name written out, you know what I'm saying? As though she never even sat on the stool because she gave it up. That really, really drives home the importance of the stool in Asante culture. And you really laid it out and did an excellent job describing and sharing with us just from the aspect of spiritual aspect, the political aspect. We're really getting an education here, and I really appreciate you sharing and just giving us some background and building upon it as we go forward. Next week, we'll be discussing with social. Did you want to discuss social next week?
Yes.
Okay. Was there anything else, any closing words, anything that you wanted to cover? Do you think we can wrap this up? So if we're doing social next week, we can say emphatically that, okay, we definitely did political slash spiritual, because this is part two, and you really, really laid it out. Any closing remarks on part two of this spiritual political model?
No, except to say that, you know, again, as we discussed last week, it's impossible to separate the spiritual from anything else in African philosophy, African culture, African society, because God is seen as the essence of everything that is experienced. So even though we'll be talking about social and environmental and economic, you know, the spiritual will always be there as a foundation upon which those aspects of the society are operating.
Well, I want to say thank you, thank you, thank you, brother, because, I mean, just the information that you shared tonight makes me want to go back and do some more research. I mean, really, truly, it makes me want to go back and really, you know, start delving into Asante and Akan culture, because this is so very, very interesting, and I look forward to next week's show, as I know that the listeners do as well. I have an announcement to make, everybody. This Friday, we also started another series last Friday, okay? Shechem Metaunetta is going to be my special guest. We're going to be talking about five-element Qigong balancing, and that show last week was the overview. So if you missed it, again, that's in the archives. That's going to be this Friday, day after tomorrow, okay? That's going to be Shechem Metaunetta. We're going to be talking about five-element balancing Qigong, okay? So we're going to explore that for about 4 or 5 weeks, so covering different energy systems. This week we're going to be looking at the lung, large intestine, kidney, urinary, bladder. So you definitely want to make sure that you tune in for that, okay? And so also upcoming, I'm sure that we'll be doing a show on the winter solstice. We just haven't scheduled that yet, but definitely be on the lookout. Hopefully I'll be able to have some information for you concerning when that show will be, because that's coming up, and you definitely want to prepare for that. Brother Orwa, again, thank you so much for your time, as always. You know, I know that you're a very busy man, and I know that for you to take time out and to share this information with us is, you know, I don't take it for granted. I mean, I know you're busy, and so I'm very, very humbled by the fact that you come on the show, and we definitely appreciate your info. Thank you so much.
Yeah, well, thank you. And talk to your last point about the winter solstice. Here in D.C., we're going to be starting our winter solstice prep class on Saturday, December the 5th at 5 p.m. So and so people should look out for the program on the solstice, but also if they're in the D.C. area, the similar classes are being offered in New York and Chicago and Philadelphia and Atlanta and other places around the country. Because the winter solstice is, in terms of, we talked about the spiritual initiation program as a process of transforming the function of our spirit to allow for the divine characteristics and qualities to flow through us. Well, the winter solstice is the prime time to begin to do that reprogramming of our spirit so that we can allow those energies to come through, so we can transform our lives and then therefore transform the world. And we can see from everything that's going on around us, this world is in dire need of a big spiritual transformation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, everybody, you heard it. If you have not undergone initiation, the winter solstice would be the perfect time to do that. Again, so make sure that, and I'll be announcing it again, December the 5th, Saturday, December the 5th. Did you say that's at 4 o'clock, Brother Orwa?
5 o'clock.
5 o'clock? Okay.
Yes.
And that's going to be at, 6225 3rd Street?
6224.
6224 3rd Street. That's Northwest Washington, D.C. And do you have a phone number for more information, Brother Orwa, that they can call? Can they call via?
202-723-5566.
Okay, everybody. That's 202-723-5566. That's for more information on the winter solstice preparation classes. And that's going to be starting on December the 5th at 5 o'clock at the Sim, starting at, that's going to be at the Simbeb Wellness Complex. Is that what it's called?
Yes.
Okay. Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And again, I'm going to be getting with you so we can just, you know, schedule when we can do that show on the winter solstice. Everybody, you definitely want to know what those days mean and that window of time and how to prepare for it. And, you know, we can talk about even getting initiated doing that because now's the time to do it, correct?
That's it.
All right. All right. Thank you so much, Orwa. As always, my brother, it's been an honor, a pleasure. Aneta Rock, I want to say thank you to all of the priests and priestesses in the Osirisa Society for all of the work that you do in helping to spread this information. To all of the Orwas and the Orwats, thank you. All of the Shechems, thank you, thank you, thank you. Until the next time, my name is Jawanza. You're listening to Health, Wealth, and Divine. My special guest today is Orwa Hehe Metura in Comet. We're in the middle, not middle, but in the process of doing a series on the Asante model. And today we covered part two of political / spirituality, and it is awesome. Go back and listen to the archives. We got shows with Orwa Hehe Metura in Comet on the 11 Laws of God. We've got Shechem and Shechem Raun Nefer Amen on Stress-Free for Life. Also, Meduna Tears 7, we've got that in there with Shechem and Shechem. We've got shows with Tepraim Sa'ah on Balancing Qigong. Again, Shechem Meta Uneta, who started a series last week, and we're going to be doing that again this Friday on Five Elements of Balancing Qigong. We've got a show with several shows, actually, with Hechem Suharu, Shechem Me'ab Neter, and he did an awesome show on the fall equinox, where he actually not only spoke about the fall equinox, but he went all around the seasons and broke it down. So, you know, if you can't wait until we do the show on the winter solstice, go back and listen to that show. I guarantee you, you're going to get a lot out of that as well, okay? So thank you, everybody, for your time. I don't take it for granted you couldn't be doing something else, and so thank you for tuning in. Until the next time, that's it.
That's it.